Welcome everyone to the Alturas Institute's presentation of America Reimagined, our radio show that invites experts from across the country to consider what America might look like under different circumstances, policies, and programs. The Alturas Institute is an educational nonprofit organization dedicated to defending American democracy by advancing the Constitution, civic education, gender equality, and equal protection of the law. Today's guest is an old friend, one of the nation's leading presidential scholars. We're joined by Professor Lori Cox Hahn, a renowned political scientist at Chapman University in California. When we talk about prolific authors, we would place Professor Hahn at the top of the list. By my count, her books now run in the neighborhood of some 15. I may be 5 or 10 behind as of this taping because she is so prolific, but you will enjoy picking up any number of her books, including Presidents and the American Presidency, Women, Power, and Politics, and among others, American Presidents and the Challenge of Democracy. She teaches a number of courses at Chapman University on political leadership, on the American presidency, on women in politics and media in politics. Today, we're so grateful to be joined by Professor Hahn to talk at this crucial juncture about different aspects of the ongoing 2020 presidential election. As all of you know, one of the major issues of concern to many Americans is the quality of polling and the accuracy of the polling that surrounded the 2020 election. Lori, it's so very, very nice to have you with us. Thank you for taking time to join us.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here to have this conversation with you.
So, Lori, as a person who studies the American presidency and writes a lot about different aspects of the office and takes up the issue of polling, please help us understand perhaps the public's misconception about the accuracy of polling, or perhaps its underestimation of the great difficulties challenging polling, because in this election, many believe that Democrats might score many more victories than they actually did. What do you think about polling these days, Lori?
Well, my first thought about polling is that I'm a little surprised that any pollsters still have a job, quite frankly, because their track record isn't all that great over these last few election cycles. You know, Lowell's got it wrong again this time. I think even more so than in 2016, and that's hard to imagine that they didn't fix some of the problems that were obviously there. And the problems are many. I mean, just from a methodological standpoint, you know, we're beyond that, if you want to call it the golden age of polling, where everybody had a landline telephone and it was much easier to get that random sample. Cell phones make it much more difficult to generate that kind of a sample that gives us a better feel of where the American public is at. And the other issues that are involved with it as well include the fact that, you know, we know that a lot of Trump supporters this time and last time really weren't represented adequately in polls. And that's for a variety of reasons. Partly, you know, some people just don't want to say publicly, yes, I support Trump, if they're talking to a live human being on the other end of the line. But also, you know, it seems that Democrats are being oversampled in polls time and time again. And so when you hear a pollster say, well, but we had the Democratic sample was right around 45-50%. Well, that's wrong, because when you look at, you know, voter affiliation these days, you know, some organizations suggest that a plurality of Americans are rejecting both parties, that they're independent, or like in my state of California, you might be registered as no party preference. So just any number of problems with how these numbers are generated. I think the biggest problem, though, with polls is they set up a media narrative for voters that is just really lacking any substance. I mean, yeah, we have so many polls that give us a day-to-day feel for where's the election at today. Well, who cares? Because we're not being informed by that. And if there's a potential for any voter suppression because the polls are so wrong, then that's a real problem. So, you know, I could go, as my students would tell you, I could go for hours on my issues with polling. But I think there's just too much attention paid to them in the news media environment, especially when we get close to an election.
You know, I appreciate that. You've just touched on numerous factors that help to explain the controversy surrounding polling in just this recent election. And I really like your point as a scholar who writes on media and politics about the fact that these polls often drove the media's narrative. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, as a scholar who specializes in that area, if those who write about the campaign are not going to write about the polls, what are they going to write about? Because we're all so hungry to know in what we perceive to be a horse race, right?
Yeah. Maybe they could write about substantive policy issues that really matter to American citizens. So, you know, I talk with my students a lot, and it's not just in my media and politics class. I cover this topic on just about every class that I teach, not only polling, but, you know, what's the role of the news media within our system of government? You know, the framers of the Constitution gave us a lot of things, but they gave us a deliberative democracy. And you need to be an informed citizenry, and you need to have more of an open access to have an ongoing dialogue about the really important issues of the day. I'm not sure that, you know, the daily tracking poll of who's up, who's down in a presidential election really is anywhere close to that. In terms of the news media also, I get my students to think a lot about the difference between news and journalism. We have a lot of news, which is a consumer-driven product. We have very little journalism, which is substantive information that voters and citizens need. And so there's not a lot of incentive right now to get the news media to give us more journalism as opposed to news. But, you know, polling is nothing but a consumer-driven product. It benefits the news media in that it's a pretty easy story for them to follow, and it's a pretty easy story for them to write or cover, especially when it's their own internal poll that they're promoting that day. But really, it leaves voters with absolutely no useful information about how to navigate the electoral environment.
And certainly it can mislead voters then, can't it?
Yes.
And some of us get excited and others become depressed.
Right.
What's the relation of those polls to raising campaign funds so critical to running campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, polling matters from the standpoint of the campaign from start to finish. You know, you've got the various phases of a presidential campaign. You've got, you know, the pre-nomination phase, where polling is going to help determine whether or not you're a viable candidate that the news media is reporting on. Then you get into the primary season, and polling is one of the key components to giving you momentum to, you know, keep raising money and to keep your campaign afloat and get to the next primary to kind of survive that process. Polling is really important throughout the summer and the conventions, because how is the news media covering you when you're not actively engaged with voters in terms of votes being cast for you and setting up the stage of, you know, the trial balloons that are put out there about potential running mates, and polls are done about that. Then we get into the general election, and then it's really the ultimate horse race. I am old enough to remember a time when polls didn't drive the media coverage the way it does now. But it's just so dominant now. And then the last phase is on election night, and we're still dealing with polling because it gets to the question of the legitimacy of the result. And I think that, you know, when you have polls that are showing this is going to be the winner, and then you see a different result, think 2016, then that's really having a negative effect on the legitimacy of the election and the ability of the people on the losing side to accept the result when all of these pollsters were telling them, oh yeah, this is in the bag for your candidate.
We want to talk to you about these topics for at least 7 or 8 more hours.
Sure.
But you, as you peel back the onion here, and it's all so fascinating, you just raised that critical issue of the legitimacy of the elections.
Yeah.
And as you well know, President Trump is unwilling to concede. Mm-hmm. He, at least as of this hour, vows to continue to fight on because he thinks that the election has been rigged.
Mm-hmm.
What's the impact of that on American citizens when they hear the President of the United States essentially demean the legitimacy of the election? What's that do to our democracy, Lori?
Well, nothing good. I mean, we're in a difficult position right now because the incumbent president is questioning the result of the election, the outcome. And, you know, I do agree he has the right to go into court and try to settle some of these issues. The Electoral College has not taken their vote yet, so we do have a little bit of time. But it's the issue of how then do we move past that? I think the legitimacy issue right now is actually partly, especially on the Trump side, is that not only that things started to look like it was moving in their direction on election night, and then as the later results came in, it kind of pushed it back toward Biden. Those of us who know how the vote comes in and which part of the state and, you know, urban versus rural environment and how that plays out, I think we kind of understood why that was happening. I think a lot of people who don't follow it the way we do maybe don't, and don't understand why that lead disappeared. But also, even though it looks like, you know, Trump is losing by not a lot in a couple of these states, the polls still were off in that the fact that he's so much closer than a lot of the polls suggested, then that's posing a problem in terms of the legitimacy also and people being willing to accept it. And when, you know, you're fed this constant media diet of, wow, look at how far Biden is ahead in all of these states, and then Trump won a couple of those, or they're so close with a razor thin margin, then that leaves a lot of doubt in a lot of people's minds and wondering, well, how did that happen? Because, you know, if the news media is telling you constantly, oh, Biden's going to win this easily, or it's going to be a blue wave, and then none of that really happens, that's a real problem.
Does you're touching on so many vital aspects of this election campaign. Let's talk for a moment about the fact that once the president reaches the end in terms of court challenges, which in some states will be upon us in a week or so, I think the state of Georgia certifies November 20, for example. Yes. What's the president's next move? Once he runs out the clock, so to speak, on court challenges, at that point, what do you think are his options?
Well, I mean, constitutionally speaking, if he hangs out in the White House until noon on January 20th and is still there, or any of his staff is still there, they'll be officially trespassing. So the Secret Service will escort them out. Let's hope it doesn't get to that point. But I think we're getting a few hints from a little bit of news coverage suggesting that he's preparing for, you know, the fact that he is going to have to concede eventually and leave. I mean, this isn't anything like 2000 in the sense that we didn't have an incumbent president. I mean, I think Bill Clinton would have been happy to stay longer if the whole thing between Bush versus Gore could have been settled. But we didn't have an incumbent president in the White House. So, you know, I'm going to make an educated guess here that those closest to him, and whether family or advisors, are telling him, look, there are a lot of things you can do in these last 2 months before you leave office. I can imagine there's a long list of pardons that are coming and some executive orders, even if Biden overturns them within a couple of weeks. I mean, I think that Trump will take the opportunity to do that. You know, I keep seeing a headline here or there about Trump thinking of 2024. You know, I don't know. I think it's too soon to speculate on whether he might try to run again, but he can also turn his attention to the Georgia Senate runoff. I can imagine that he will take the opportunity to do several rallies in the state of Georgia because we know how much he enjoys those. And, you know, I think that if cooler heads prevail and explain to him that, hey, you might not be president, but you're still the leader of this movement you put into place 5.5 years ago, you can still have a role here. You can be that kingmaker in Republican politics. I think that that might make it a little easier for him to accept. You know, I don't imagine that he will ever really accept that he lost, but, you know, his words can be very different than his actions, because if he does at least concede and, you know, take part in the peaceful transition, then he can kind of have his cake and eat it too, because he can still tell his most ardent supporters, hey, you know, this was stolen from us. But on the other hand, over here, in terms of the process to do what is constitutionally mandated.
And as you say, if in fact he's reluctant or simply unwilling to make a concession, but to rest the outcome on a rigged election, he has just laid the predicate for his next run in 2024, hasn't he?
Exactly. Exactly.
And his given the fact that he would pursue his own best interest, it would be in his interest to campaign as much as possible in those Georgia Senate runoffs so as to show his base that he's alive and that he's going to bring full energy to the next campaign.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine him not doing that. You know, as much as some of us would love for this election to already be over. Let's face it, election 2020 is not over until both of those races are called sometime after January 5th. So we've got a ways to go in terms of the balance of power. I mean, if the Senate didn't hang in the balance in terms of which party was going to be in control, we might not even be paying much attention to this outside of the state of Georgia, but a lot still on the line.
You know, and we should say, as many expressed concern about Donald Trump staying active in American politics, particularly Republican politics, he has a grasp on that party, doesn't he?
Yes.
And yeah. How does that party reorient itself if Donald Trump stays as kingmaker?
Well, both parties are facing challenges in terms of their identity. This election resolved nothing about that. Because Republicans, you know, are split between the Trump part of the party and then the never Trumpers. And so, you know, where does something like the Lincoln Project go from here with all of those Republicans who were just fighting so hard to get Donald Trump out of the White House? He's not going anywhere. And so the Republican Party is going to have to reconcile that, figure out how they move forward, what are the 2022 midterms going to look like, because they're going to have another tough electoral map to face in terms of the Senate in 2022. But they might have an advantage in that a Democrat's going to be in the White House. So that gives them, you know, a good advantage to get their message out and argue against whatever they don't like in the Biden administration. But the Democrats are in a similar situation because, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges Biden faces is what kind of a Democrat is he going to be now? Is he going to do what he says and be governed from a bipartisan standpoint? I think maybe he has a better shot of doing that than even Barack Obama did, because he's got that relationship with Mitch McConnell and a lot of other senators. He's got a vice president now who's coming from the Senate. So she knows a lot of the newer senators that Biden never got the chance to work with because he hasn't been there since 2008. But then what do you do with the progressives? I mean, there are a lot of people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, that are really pushing to get cabinet appointments. You know, it'd be interesting with Elizabeth Warren because there's a Republican governor in Massachusetts. So if she gets a cabinet position, that Republican seat or that Senate seat is going to go Republican for at least 2 years. That might be part of the equation. But how does Joe Biden reconcile the I think an even bigger civil war within the Democratic Party? For the Republicans, it seems to be a little bit more about personalities, you know, Trump or not Trump. But within the Democratic Party, these are real serious issues about where does the agenda go.
You certainly make critical points about the future of the Democratic Party and how, in fact, Joe Biden may be able to reconcile differences between the moderates and the progressives. Mm-hmm. If Biden does not support the progressive mission in a variety of ways, does that imperil the Democratic Party in the 2022 midterm elections?
It's possible, because then you could see some, you know, some younger progressive members of the party, you know, challenging incumbents in House and Senate seats. I mean, there are rumors and rumblings out there about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez possibly primarying Chuck Schumer in New York. I mean, that would be a clear sign that these issues have not been resolved within the Democratic Party. But the Republican Party has to figure that out too. I mean, what kind of a party are they going to be? But they cannot afford to ignore the Trump supporters. So I think that Republicans would be better off to focus on the policy issues. Take some of the policy successes that Trump has had. I mean, he actually got quite a bit done while president. We don't talk about that a lot. And there's a lot that some Republicans, the more established Republicans, actually feel good about in terms of what Trump accomplished. But they've got to be able to separate it away from this is the policy, this is where we want the party to be, and stop focusing on Trump and his personality. And that's a challenge.
You're speaking as a very knowledgeable and well-informed political scientist that you are. Let's turn, Lori, to a question on the minds of many Americans right now during this interregnum. Many fear that there are national security implications for America at stake by President Trump's unwillingness to give the go-ahead to the General Services Administration to trigger the Presidential Transition Act. Where do you come down on those kinds of concerns?
Well, I'm hopeful that will happen soon. I think some folks, Republicans in the Senate, have indicated today that it's time to get Joe Biden in on the briefings and to kind of start moving that process. You know, 2000 does give us a good example of it took a long time for there to be I mean, a long time within that transition period anyway, for there to be a declared winner in that presidential race. You know, the difference there also with here is that while the news media initially declared George W. Bush the winner, then they took that back. And so we were without that declarative statement from the news media. Even though the news media doesn't really have the authority to do it, we still rely on them. And I don't know that there's, beyond wishful thinking for a lot of Trump supporters, there's really any chance for the election outcome to be overturned. I mean, it would take several states having those results overturned to actually swing it back to Trump. But I do have faith in our constitutional system, and you know, you can rail against the establishment in Washington all you want, and there's plenty to criticize. But I think that those forces within Washington who know the system will eventually win out, and hopefully sooner or right. I think that we will see that happen. And, you know, one of the advantages, I think, to Biden being, you know, such a Washington insider, I mean, there are plenty of disadvantages from an electoral standpoint, but he knows the system and he knows what he needs to do. And it looks like he's starting to move in that direction to put together his team and be ready to go by January 20th.
You know, to your point, as you know, the New York Times recently surveyed virtually every secretary of state or the office in all 50 states, and no one disclosed any evidence of significant fraud in the election. That's important for American citizens to understand, isn't it? So that they don't lose faith in the electoral process.
Yeah, I mean, depending on what media outlet you're paying attention to right now, you might get a completely different story. I think one thing that we do know is that we need, in every state, we need to do a better job with this, because there are too many instances where, you know, you have people who are deceased who are voting. You have ballots being mailed to an address for someone who hasn't lived there in quite some time. I mean, these were the problems that were inevitable when you went to, you know, sending out a mail-in ballot to everyone who's registered. I mean, I'm in California, so everybody got a ballot. That's an awful lot of people, especially in a time period where people are moving around quite a bit just because of the dire economic circumstances some people are facing. So I think that what we can take from this is that, hey, we need to clean up some of this stuff. We need to do a better job with this. If we want to do mail-in voting, we need to figure out a way to make it more secure and to make sure that we don't have these problems. Are there enough of those issues to overturn the results in an election? We don't see any state where Florida was 20 years ago, you know, 537 votes. And I think you and I would probably both agree, you know, I tried to explain this to my students 2 days ago, but, you know, they're all in their early 20s, so I don't think they appreciate it, that, hey, Florida's kind of setting the example of how we do this right now, where 20 years ago, Florida was just the thing. I mean, they were such a mess that they held up the whole process, but I think that that might be a good place to look for a lot of these other states to figure out, hey, let's make sure we don't have this happen.
Sure. Again. You know, it would be fun to solicit your opinion on a few issues that Americans like to talk about every once in a while. Should the nation move toward fuller use of mail-in ballots and overcome the kinds of administrative problems that you cited?
I guess, and my perspective on this also, being a native Californian and being in the largest state, yes, but with a few caveats. You know, just if we're going to rely on the post office right now, I think that that does not exactly instill a lot of trust in people. So it's not only how every state is registering voters and keeping track of who's registered, who isn't, where, you know, they're living. We might want to take a closer look through a nonpartisan lens, if that's possible, at the post office and the role that they are going to play. I mean, you know, out here in California, there were official drop boxes for ballots, and then there were some that were not official that the Republican Party was putting out. So that caused a big problem. So we need to address all of these issues so everybody, regardless of who they're registered, what party they're registered with, or if they're registered no party, has trust in the system. So I think that there's tremendous potential. I'm always for increased voter turnout, but I want to make sure that these ballots are secure. You know, I'm skeptical of certainly the process of ballot harvesting. I think that we all need to address this. You know, whether or not we address it on a national level, I'm not sure that that's where it needs to be. I think, but states need to take a long, hard look and make sure that what is in place is trusted by the voters.
And, you know, the continuation of the Electoral College is always on the minds of citizens from coast to coast, as you well know. Do you suppose that there will be interest among Republicans in at least considering abolition of the Electoral College now that they look at new alignments and changing, shifting demographic patterns?
There might be some interest. I think what we might see is maybe a handful of states doing what Nebraska and Maine already do with proportional allocation of their electoral votes. I've been talking about this for years now. I mean, ever since in 2000, where the Electoral College suddenly became relevant. You know, there's just not a lot of incentive for any of the states to get on board with a constitutional amendment to do away with it, because we can you know, reform it a bit, but that's state by state if you want to do the proportional allocation of delegates. But here's the problem with that too. In a state like California, I mean, Democrats have pretty much a supermajority up in Sacramento. So why at this point would they want to do that? Because they get all 55 electoral votes. Why mess with that? So you might see that in a couple of red states. But even then, if it's a red state right now, and if you do that, then you might be giving up a handful of electoral votes to the Democrats. So there's no incentive to everybody to get together and say, hey, let's fix this. There's just an awful lot of complaining and whining about it every 4 years. Although given that, you know, Biden won the Electoral College and the popular vote, that discussion might just kind of die down for a little bit until we have another popular vote winner that loses the Electoral College.
And so you raise an interesting point about the incentive of political parties versus perhaps the principle of what's better for the nation, as we discuss the Electoral College is it, because it is anti-democratic in nature. And we could talk about this for 4 years.
Yes.
But how do we approach that issue of somehow persuading politicians to take a look at what constitutes the general welfare as opposed to their own particular interests? Nobody's ever talked about this, I'm sure, for 2 years, right?
Yeah. Wow. To try to get politicians to look past their own partisan and personal objectives to do what's in the best interest of the country, that's a tall order right now. I don't know. I often pose this kind of question to my students and they kind of just stare back at me because they expect me to have the answer. And I always say, no, you're the next generation of leaders. I need you to have the answer to that. You know, I think it's just an unfortunate byproduct of our political system that we never tend to have those conversations. I mean, look at the situation we're in right now with this pandemic, you know, and now we're probably going to have a debate over the next couple of weeks of whether or not we should have a national lockdown versus, you know, letting the states do it. That's kind of the ultimate issue of federalism, right? Who has the authority to do these things? But it's tough to get everybody on board. I mean, this issue has been politicized right from the start, just as every other issue has been. So I don't know how we get out of this hyperpartisan mode to really talk about what we need to do as a nation. For the last several years, I've been saying it's going to take a pretty serious crisis to make us do that. Well, this pandemic is a serious crisis, and we're still just as politicized and divided as we were before. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but I'm skeptical that we will get a national lockdown if for no other reason that, you know, it's really cutting out the role that states play. And I, you know, although I got to tell you, out in California, I'm not sure that we would notice the difference if we were in a national lockdown right now, because in a lot of the states, things have already pretty much closed up anyway, again, so.
Right, and in our last minute or two together, Lori, Senator and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris hails from your state of California, and she would be in line to run for the presidency soon, depending on how long perhaps Joe Biden decides he wants to remain president, right? Because some have speculated maybe he'll choose to serve a single term. Given your many and considerable writings on women in politics, are we far removed from the day in which, to use the title of one of your many books, are we ready to elect Madam President?
Well, we may have already done that this time. I'm very pragmatic in how I approach these things. So I try not to pull any punches. But, you know, Joe Biden's going to be 78 years old when he takes the oath of office in 2 months. I think it would be very unlikely that he would run for a second term. We could be facing a situation where she could succeed to the presidency before we even get to that point. But let's assume that, you know, Biden decides he's only going to serve one term, and that, you know, obviously she becomes the front runner.
So, Professor Lori Cox Hahn, I'm so sorry that our time together has just gone by way too quickly, which tells me we absolutely need you back to join us for additional conversations on America Reimagined. Thank you so very much for joining us today. I appreciate your pragmatism, your many insights and observations and comments about American politics.
Thanks, David. It was great to be here, and I'm happy to come back anytime.
We'll look forward to it. And ladies and gentlemen, you've just seen the latest edition of America Reimagined. Now, please step back and enjoy this beautiful arrangement of America the Beautiful, created by our wonderful musician Steve Eaton, performed by State Senator Sheree Buckner-Webb and the 8-year-old phenom Charlotte Laval. Thanks again for joining us. This is the Alturas Institute, America Reimagined.
Waves of grain for purple mountains, majesty.